You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of November 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme, as Brussels extends its lockdown into a fourth day in a row, our guests Oscar Guardiola Rivera and James Boyes will assess this and the day's other top stories. David Cameron lends a helping hand to Francois Hollande's campaign in Syria, but which other world leaders are uniting in the fight against ISIS? And also ahead...
Thank you for having believed, for believing that together we can build the Argentina that we dream of. Thank you. I'm here because of the decision you all made.
12 years of Peronism come to an end as the mayor of Buenos Aires and opposition candidate wins last night's elections in Argentina. Will he be able to bring the country back to its former glory? And finally...
I will absolutely take database on the people coming in from Syria if we can't stop it, but we're going to. And if I win, I've made it known, if I win, they're going back. We can't have them.
More out-and-out racism, frankly, from a genuine contender for the American presidency. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at Birkbeck University, and the political historian James Boyes. Oscar and James, welcome to you both. We begin in Belgium. The country is essentially shut down, or at least the capital, Brussels, is, with schools, museums and many shops closed throughout the day. The government has announced that the lockdown will continue while the army carries out another series of anti-terror raids, which have already resulted in the arrests of 21 people. One of the suspected gunmen involved in the Paris attacks, Salah Abdeslam, remains at large. James Boyes, in some ways... You know, many people will have some sympathy for the authorities in Belgium. Mm-hmm. It's everyone is understandably very nervous at the moment, and they, this phrase "better be safe than sorry" is used a lot at the moment. But the longer it goes on like this, the more you have to worry that either they don't know what they're doing, or you know, we're moving into an area which is a little uncomfortable for everyone.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the challenges you've got here, of course, is that, you know, the first requirement of any government is to protect its citizens. And if it believes it's got actionable intelligence, which says we need to take this drastic step, then obviously, you know, the rights of the citizens have to be considered in terms of their overall livelihood. But of course, one of the challenges is that, you know, you look at Belgium, and I think the mistake to make is to assume that all European countries have a similar approach to national security that Great Britain does, which of course they don't. There are very, very different approaches. The UK is arguably more like the US in terms of its approach to national security, the way it deals with a lot of these issues, and the way in which its internal security structure is put together. You go to somewhere like Belgium, for example, they've got a very, very different approach to how national security is addressed. And they've got less of a history of dealing with these issues. I mean, for whatever reason, if you think about how the UK, for example, has grown up, as I think most of us around this table have, with issues to do with Irish terrorism, for example, we've got a long history of having to deal with these issues. And I think that the way we've gotten used to dealing with it is imbued within, you know, the structure and the personnel who are involved in running it. You go across the continent to places like Belgium, for example, you know, they're dealing with this on a very ad hoc basis, I think. And the question about operability within the system, I think, becomes a real challenge. And the longer it goes on, I mean, how long can you keep a country in lockdown for?
Well, indeed, Oscar, on that question, you know, you're talking about a major capital city, the heart of the European Union. One day, perhaps two over the weekend, you know, people in extraordinary circumstances can perhaps understand. But, you know, it's going to go into a fourth day tomorrow, and that's going to become increasingly difficult for residents in Brussels.
the exception ceases to be an exception if it becomes the norm. And that seems to be what is happening here. On the one hand, this response seems completely reactive, and that's problematic. It does make it look as if the authorities were always on the back foot, or responding just after the facts. A lot of people have been wondering, why is it that now all these raids take place? Why do they know now that all these people were there? Did they know before? If not, why they didn't preempt this situation from happening? That's one thing. On the other hand, yes, there is a problem with how the public can deal with this. The longer it goes, the less exceptional these circumstances become, and people begin to question if the state of exception is indeed exceptional.
On that point, James, in terms of what security services know, we've seen in Germany this week where there was the incident last week with the football match at Hanover, sure. And conflicting reports coming out now of some media saying, well, actually, it seems like there was a plot that mm-hmm. was stopped, and others saying actually there have been some intelligence from France, but there's intelligence pretty much every week saying there's a cell sure. that's trying to plot something. It's becoming increasingly difficult for even the security services to work out what's a rumour and what's actionable intelligence.
Absolutely, and this is one of the great problems, of course. I mean, you can imagine the situation, can't you? We could be sitting here now, the authorities had let the match go ahead, an incident occurs, and now all of a sudden people are asking, well, hang on, we had actionable intelligence, why didn't we do something about it? This is one of the great problems, as Margaret Thatcher famously said, the terrorists only have to be right once, we have to be right all the time, effectively, and stop them all the time. It's very, very difficult to have that sort of a 100% success rate. It's difficult to sit here and criticise the authorities in some respects, because of course, we were rightly saying this idea that the authorities are reacting, but that's all we can do. I mean, if we were sitting here talking about taking preemptive strikes against some of these individuals, of course, that was what the Bush administration was critiqued for quite widely. I appreciate it was on a different scale in its time in office, but the Paris attacks, I think, have changed the political temperature, not only in Europe, but across the world, and particularly in the United States, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little later on, to a point by which even left-to-centre administrations, which previously might have been very, very reticent to get involved in this sort of action, I think now recognise the need to do so.
Oscar, you mentioned before about when the exception then becomes not the exception anymore, and we've seen in France were all along calling for a 3-month state of emergency and Parliament going along with that. Does that worry you? Do you worry that we're in danger of getting that balance between security and liberty wrong?
Oh, it does, because we have an immediate precedent. In fact, after the Bush administration engaged in so-called preemptive strikes, which were not really that preemptive, what happened internally was precisely a loss of balance between security and liberty. And when that happens, we all know that it's the terrorist wins. If they do provoke in our societies the feeling that nobody's safe, nowhere is safe, that, and also that what really matters is just safety and security, we lose fact of the importance of liberty. We have that with the Patriot Act. We have that in this country with the loss of civil liberties, and that is again in danger.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in with that. I think we have to be very, very careful. It's very easy, I think, to look back at what happened in the aftermath of 9/11 and talk about a loss of liberties on behalf of the American people. But let's cut this in context. In the immediate aftermath of Pearl Harbor, Franklin Roosevelt interned Japanese Americans who'd committed no crime whatsoever for the duration of the war. Woodrow Wilson basically had an internal policy of basically reading everybody's mail. So I think we need to be...
Lincoln, are we saying then, so long as there's no internment of Japanese people, then it's fine.
What I'm saying is we need to keep it in context. There were no Muslim Americans were interned on the American continent after 9/11. I mean, trying to put this into historical...
the bar quite low, though, isn't it?
Yes.
No, what I'm saying is, yeah, is if you want to go back at a historical analogy, you know, Abraham Lincoln suspends habeas corpus. Wilson basically starts reading people's mail, and FDR is interning American citizens of Japanese heritage. So this idea that there is parallels across the American history, which came nowhere close to being paralleled under George W. Bush.
But James, I'm sure you wouldn't go that far with the analogy. In fact, one might question whether this is the correct analogy. In fact, if we'll talk about this, if Donald Trump wins, we may have internment of Muslims and so on.
We'll come on to Donald Trump in a moment.
As you say, we have to be very careful.
I just want to pick up, James, just on one thing there. You said about reading people's mail.
Right.
That's happening right now. Yeah, it's just email, not written letters.
That what the security services are able to do is to track metadata, and that is happening to an extent. But if anybody thinks that the security services are sitting around reading everybody's mail, I wish the American government had that much resources at their disposal. They simply don't. There is a metadata trail which is being tracked for some individuals, but I don't think it's been done on the extent or to the depth that an awful lot of people think. It's the same with the whole waterboarding thing. If you ask people how many people were waterboarded, people think it was hundreds of people, and we're talking about actually a handful of people at one site in particular.
We're going to go off on a weird tangent here, but the issue of waterboarding isn't about how many people it affects.
No, not at all.
It's about whether it's effective.
It's about whether it's right or wrong.
But there's a different argument there, whereas in terms of the collection of data, the argument is, you know, on the one hand, do you collect on people that you have some suspicion of, or do you collect it on absolutely everyone, which is what was happening?
Well, I think if you look at what it is that was being suggested by Edward Snowden, I think there's a degree to which there needs to be a question about whether that's been actually verified or not. There's no doubt about it that some of the material that was put into the public domain by that was highly questionable, and the appropriateness of it is problematic, I think, quite frankly.
Okay, we'll move on from there rather than delving more into it. Now, in the aftermath of the events in Paris, it seems that world leaders are beginning to unite in a campaign against ISIS, although for different countries that means different things. Today, the British Prime Minister, David Cameron, gave strong backing to Francois Hollande, offering the use of the Royal Air Force base in Cyprus, from which France can launch airstrikes against ISIS in Syria. Hollande seems to be on something of a tour to persuade world leaders to join this fight. Tomorrow he'll be meeting with US President Barack Obama, as well as with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Oscar Guardiola Rivera, you know, we seem to be at least having a situation now where world leaders recognise that there is a problem with ISIS and that something needs to be done. Although that phrase, something needs to be done, isn't necessarily always a helpful one. Do you get a sense that there is a strategy here?
I do hope there is, and there is, there is evidence that something is changing. On the one hand, we have already seen a change of strategy in the fact that France and the U.S. are now attacking the resource lines. They are striking oil fields and so on. That should have been done a long time ago, but at least we're doing that. That's important. On the other hand, we will see a change in terms of the Assad, not Assad point, which continues to divide these countries. It is likely, I believe, that Russia, which has already hinted at this, will not continue to insist that Assad must remain at all costs. I mean, again, Russia has already hinted at this. And this should pave the way towards stronger connections.
James Boyce, there are two ways that an agreement can be found between generally the West and Russia. One is, as Oscar was suggesting there, that Vladimir Putin might accept that, okay, we can, you know, we don't need Assad as part of the solution. We can try and come to find some sort of arrangement and let's focus on ISIS. Mm-hmm. The other is that actually the West says, fine, we'll agree with Vladimir Putin and, you know, you get to keep Assad and let's not worry about the regime and let's all unite to fight ISIS. Mm-hmm. Which one of those two do you think is most likely?
the latter at this point, I think. I think it'd be very, very difficult, quite frankly, for Putin to walk away from his attachment to Assad. I think that for a long time he has maintained that commitment. I appreciate that Putin is a pragmatist of the utmost order. But I also think that there's a degree to which he sees an attachment with Assad, and to walk away from that would be very, very difficult. There's no doubt. I mean, you were asking about questions about strategy. I think it's just being made upon the hoof as we go along, quite frankly. You know, the West has talked about Assad having to go for so long. Now, all of a sudden, that looks increasingly unlikely. You know, and the extent to which, therefore, you know, Putin comes out of this ahead, quite frankly, holding a lot of cards, is, I think, inescapable. The great risk now is you're putting American ground troops on the floor in terms of special forces. You know, they're going to be in the direct line of fire from Russian aerial bombardment. It doesn't take a genius to figure out that this could lead to catastrophe very, very quickly and lead to an escalating situation in which the question about what to do with ISIS becomes a secondary problem.
Although what's interesting, Oscar, is that there's been a UN Security Council resolution signed on by all five members of the permanent five, saying that action must be taken against ISIS. Does that at least sort of... Okay, no one feels good about any of this, but does that at least make you think, well, look, there is some sense of unanimity. We're not in a situation as with Libya, where you had Britain, France and the US on one side and Russia and China on the other?
At the very least, one can say that the legal case has been made. Although there is no detail in the resolution as to what kind of action, one should think that that kind of action will strive to avoid the sort of catastrophic scenario that James very correctly warns us against. So there has to be some kind of coordination. Again, I do believe that for the moment Assad will remain in the picture, but only for the moment, because it is also becoming increasingly clear to all parties that there has to be a strategy for what happens the day after ISIS is defeated militarily, if it can be defeated at all, and that requires deep thinking on all sides.
James, you mentioned American forces inside Syria. We're talking about 50 special forces
at the moment.
Yeah, at the moment, and that's what's been publicly admitted anyway. But in terms of an actual ground force, because let's face it, you know, it's impossible for this coalition to rely on the Kurds, because they won't go outside Kurdistan.
Yep.
It's impossible to rely on what we might call moderate Syrian rebel groups, because
nobody knows who they are.
And that's been tried, and there might only be about 7 or 8 actual people of them left. So that involves then some form of ground force. Now, how likely is it that Turkey, the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia would be persuaded to send in any troops?
Highly unlikely. I mean, in an ideal world, from an American point of view, the US would provide logistical support, financial support, and the nations in the region would step up and do the fighting. And I think that it's a great source of frustration in Washington, D.C., that these states are just not doing so. We sit here now in London, and there'll be people sitting in Washington talking about the threat to London as a capital, to Washington, D.C., posed by ISIS. But, you know, the nations in that proximity are the ones who face the most danger potentially from this organization if it's allowed to spread, and yet they want to do nothing to combat it, it would seem.
On that point, though, James, if you were sitting now in Ankara and you've got a border of 570-odd miles that you share with Syria, would you not also be slightly concerned about the idea of, as you may see it there, escalating and sending in your own troops and making your country a new target?
You know, it's difficult. I'm sitting here thinking, I'm really getting pushed to look like the hawk.
I realise
the situation that I'm in, but the question is, at what point do you fight the fight? I mean, Turkey, I would have thought, would be a classic example of a nation which much realise. You think about where Turkey is geographically, culturally, in terms of its heritage. You know, does it want to be in Europe or in Asia? Does it want to be religiously based in terms of its government or not? You know, Turkey is going to be an obvious threat from someone like ISIS at some point in the very near future if they're not attacked and defeated. I mean, we're talking about taking them out militarily. You know, they've got skin in the game. If they can't see the reason to get involved in a coalition to go in there and take these people out, I don't know what gives, quite frankly.
Also, everybody knows that what is happening in Syria is also a war by proxy. The Saudis are using proxy wars, and the Turkish are doing it as well. Also, historically speaking, there is the argument that what we are witnessing is the sort of coming back of the ghost of the fall of the Ottoman Empire haunting us back. And Turkey is at the very heart of that. So actually, it is very important that Turkey, Saudi Arabia are brought back to the table. It's going to be very difficult to persuade them. And if that is the case, then the so-called Western allies will have to be much more decisive.
Just one quick thing to you, Oscar. We've talked about Syria a lot over the last 2 or 3 years on this program. And you've always been very much against the idea of any sort of military intervention. Have your views changed on this over the past few months?
I think so. I think they have changed. Not in the sense that I now believe that this should this will be resolved by solely by military means. But I do acknowledge that what is happening with ISIL needs a decisive response, and that response may also include military means.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, and my guests, Oscar Guardiola Rivera and James Boyes. When we're back, Argentina and Donald Trump.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the program as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the program that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, Oscar Guardiola Rivera and James Boyes. Now, 12 years of Kirchner rule has been brought to an end in Argentina. The opposition's Mauricio Macri has been elected as the country's new president. It was one of the narrowest margins ever recorded. Macri won 51.4% of the vote, while his rival Daniel Scioli had 48 point something or other. Oscar, this is now. Was this a defeat for the political idea of Peronism, or was it also a little bit of a defeat for the Cristina soap opera?
I guess the answer is complicated, unfortunately. Both yes and no. Yes, because what is interesting about this is that for the first time, you don't have a president that belongs either to the right wing, the right side of Peronism, or the left wing side of Peronism. Macri, you could say, is a bona fide representative of the right wing and the industrialist class.
One of those who gets described as pro-business, which basically
kind
is,
of, you know, exactly, you know, exactly.
The big business is backed.
The kind of person who includes the former president of Shell Argentina in his cabinet and so on, which is exactly what is happening here. So that's interesting, because we're going to see if Argentina's experiment without Peronism works at a difficult time economically in global terms, which is really what was the limit for most progressive governments in Latin America. That on the one hand. On the other hand, people were really clearly tired of Cristina's bombastic style. Although she remains popular, it has to be said, she leaves office with the kind of percentage that other governments would envy. The divisive nature, the fact that she's called by some Queen Cristina and by others Queen of Hell, is part of what explains what happened here.
James Boyes, even for people who may be fans of Cristina, even they would at least accept that this perhaps is no bad thing for Argentina's democracy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you're talking about 12 years of rule there, I mean, you know, as we've seen it in the United States, we've seen it in Great Britain, questions about whether term limits should be in place or not. Clearly, Oscar was talking about this idea that, you know, she leaves office very, very popular. You know, I guess the question could be, if she could run for another term in office, would she have been elected? Possibly.
Possibly.
When you look at how close the results were, you know, one would wonder on a sort of an intellectual level whether that's a break upon democracy itself. You know, if the people want to elect an individual, if Bill Clinton could have run for a third term, would he have been elected, for example, or Ronald Reagan? So this is a question about, you know, intellectual approach to democracy, I guess.
And Oscar, in terms of the challenges ahead for Macri, so you know, the economy is obviously one major one, but also dealing with issues of corruption as well.
The challenge is huge, and this is one of the reasons why, you know, somebody was asking me before, am I happy? No, I'm not happy that Macri got elected. But I'm quite relieved because I want to see the proper right wing in Latin America to see if they are capable of, realizing their promises. Macri has promised return to the glory days of Argentina's economy, which means what? The late 19th century. I mean, it's very, very, very problematic.
Things were very different then.
Things were clearly very different. So, inflation on the one hand, that's going to be difficult to control. Also, let us remember that he has no majority in Congress at all, and that's very important. He's going to find it very difficult to negotiate with the unions as well.
Okay, finally, yes.
Finally.
Let's turn to Donald Trump. The presidential hopeful is making headlines once again and again, not for any good reason. This time, Trump has been accused of running a hate campaign after he claimed he had seen thousands of Arabs cheering the 9/11 attacks in New Jersey. He's also asked for a database for Syrian migrants and that certain mosques should have greater surveillance. James Boyes, you know, in some ways we can just say, look, there are always interesting characters in the Republican presidential race. But this feels like something different now, doesn't it?
Yes. The great challenge here with Donald Trump, of course, is you've got someone who's not a professional politician, who's not used to playing the game, entering into the race and at this point running away with it. A lot of people keep telling people about, oh, Donald Trump can't become the nominee. I've yet to see a reason why he can't at this point. If elections were held today, he'd be winning a series of primaries across the country. He is using, as you say, extremely inflammatory language, which I think a lot of people within the Republican Party have got a great problem with. One of the things which isn't being said is that, yes, he's polling at somewhere between 23 and 25% in some cases. That does mean, to be fair, to moderate Republicans that 75% of the people who are supporting Republicans don't agree with him.
Well, I know, of that 75%, there's also another chunk that's supporting Ben Carson.
I'm not...
that's the problem.
Yeah, I'm shaking my head here if anybody's listening. There is a problem with this rise of non-professional politicians getting in the game and offering seemingly simple solutions to very complex problems.
Oscar, there's also a problem here in that a lot of this is hate speech. If Donald Trump were to be a politician in Europe and were to come out with lies, outright lies like this, that claiming that thousands of Arabs, thousands of Muslims had been cheering the destruction of the Twin Towers on 9/11, they would... You know, they'd be run out of town. They'd be talked about for what they were, a far right candidate.
Well, I'm not sure I'm not as optimistic on that as you are. But I get the point. It is true that he is just telling lies. But we live at a time in which politicians know that they can tell lies and sometimes get away with it. Now, what I really hate about what he said is that he said so in Alabama to the sound of Lynyrd Skynyrd, Sweet Home Alabama, which is a progressive song. He's not, and he's twisting everything. That's incredibly bad. Now you said that there are interesting characters in the Republicans always. Well, now they are full of just these interesting, so-called interesting characters, and this has to be taken seriously. He prefaces these allegations by saying, "I know this is not politically correct. This is not a problem of political correctness. This is straightforward racism."
very quickly, sure. James. Last time around, there was Herman Cain, there was Rick Santorum, and then eventually there was Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
In 6 months' time, will we have had our fill of Carson and Trump?
Yes, I believe so. I mean, the thing is, you know, Herman Cain flared out very, very quickly. I think ultimately it will come down to a professional Republican nominee, and if they've got any sense, they'll put someone like Marco Rubio forward. If he puts together a team with John Kasich, the Democrats are in all sorts of trouble.
Okay, James Boies and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, thank you both very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Piers Ellison. The studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. For the next half hour, Chris Chilvers will be here, and then it's Culture with Robert Bowne. That's at 1900. Midori House, back same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.